Ready to go?
I will be, yes.
I don't know what that means.
I have to get the agenda up.
You know, no, you never look at it. You're fine.
Well, I mean, I should at least know something, right?
Sure, if you think so.
Okay.
In 3, 2... Oh, fuck, I forgot what episode we're on.
96.
Thank you. In 3, 2... And welcome to episode 96 of Up and In, the Baseball Prospectus Podcast. In lovely DeKalb, Illinois, I'm Kevin Goldstein. In lovely Brooklyn, New York, he's Jason Parks. Jason, it's your turn to say hello.
Howdy. Thank you.
Thank you. What are you thanking?
The audience.
Okay. We have a great show for you. We're going to, I'm going to clear my throat. We're going to go through all your email. We're going to talk about baseball. We're going to talk about things we wrote this week. I did a piece where I polled the industry on pitcher choices, choosing starting pitchers right now and choosing starting pitchers 3 years from now. My phone's going to ring. We'll talk about something pretty remarkable Jason wrote about the high ceiling raw player and how dreaming on those might kind of be a myth. It was really a great piece, Jason. It was thought provoking. We'll talk about I just want to talk about the Cubs briefly and talk about because the Cubs suck and they're just awful and a horrible baseball team to watch, and it's not like they're bad and fun, they're just bad and terrible, that the anger and the hatred is all of a sudden pointed at the best player on the team by a mile, and I'm going to point out why that's so damn stupid. And then we'll talk about some questions on Twitter that I get and why I don't answer them. particularly about ceilings and making up trades. From there, well, our special guest will be Kendall Rogers from Perfect Game. He's going to preview the College World Series going on in Omaha. We had a really great Super Regional round. We had some big surprises with Stony Brook and Kent State. We'll talk about who's in. We'll make him pick somebody. And because he's from Texas, you never really know what's going to happen. Because, you know, he's from Texas, Jason's from Texas, and when Texans get together, stupid things happen. And then we'll take
he'll say something stupid, I guarantee.
We'll talk about our musical guest, Dimesland, who I saw live a few weeks ago. Talk about what we're drinking. Pop culture moment. Jason wrote about kind of the storylines of the first half of the minor league season, and he wrapped them around quotes from the greatest film of the 90s, Boogie Nights. We're going to talk about Boogie Nights and how amazing it is. And then we'll talk about what's going on, and we'll be done, and that'll be that.
Okay. Sounds good.
Housekeeping time. If you want to email us, keep the emails coming. We still have plenty of episodes left to go, Jason. It's 96. It's hardly done. Email us at podcast@baseballprospectus.com. If you want to follow us on Twitter, I'm at Kevin_Goldstein. Jason is at Professor Parks with a new avatar of Michael Landon. And, that's got to be a good thing, really. You never know what you're going to get. And what else? We have a Facebook group that seems to be busier than ever, really, with people talking
people
about...
People use it.
People use it. People use it just not just to talk about the show, but to kind of have, it's like a world where they can talk with fellow fans about baseball stuff, too. And so that's in there. And, from there, we'll keep that going. And it's gotten kind of busier than ever. And thank you for that. And if you are an iTunes... And Aaron writes, greetings, ambassadors of want. So Byron Buxton is in Minneapolis for his physical today. He took his pregame batting practice with the Twins before their game with the Phillies. Now, there are millions of reasons why this cannot, would not, and should not happen. But let's say there's some alternate universe loophole where the Twins can insert Buxton into their lineup tonight for one game only, and they do so. He's playing center field, batting second. What is the range of possibility for this experiment? I know Buxton is a work in progress with a long way to go. This isn't like asking if a polished college arm could slot into middle relief. Buxton's raw. So how raw do these guys start out? Would you bet on him making contact against in-game major league pitching? Or is even that too much to ask? What about defense? Can he play a passable center field right now? Would a casual fan who doesn't know about this experiment be able to watch the game and say, hey, that guy doesn't belong here? As always, love the podcast. Keep up the great work. Aaron in San Francisco.
It's a great question.
It's really fun question. And I actually think the casual fan, at least at the plate, would be able to watch the game and go, Yeah, he doesn't belong here. I mean,
It'll look too fast for him.
I would guess, I mean, I'd predict 0 for 4 with 3 Ks. That would be my prediction.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is that you can't really predict that. I mean,
Now, if it's
I
like
agree
that.
with you. I agree with you, but you know, I watched an 18-year-old kid get a hit off a major league pitcher in a backfield game once. He just threw the bat out and got a pitch
Right.
to hit, and he worked with it. He's a capable hitter. That said, the speed of the major league game would really, I think, it would overwhelm an 18-year-old kid.
Would have to.
You know, and I think that would be, people in the stands would be able to tell that the speed of the game was too much for the kid. He'd
Right.
play too fast. It would be too fast.
And that's the thing. He actually could, get some, get the bat going, close his eyes, get a single. He could go 2 for 4. It's the thing is, if it was a, a 30-game experiment, after those 30 games, he'd be hitting about 120.
Right, or if he were on the Phillies, he might be able to get a hit off the Twins.
And
That kind of pitching, hitting
right.
90 miles an hour.
I mean, as far as center field, I think it would take a while to realize that, he has some work to do in the routes and stuff. But, he'd chase the fall balls down and get them. The other routes wouldn't be perfect, but he's got more than enough speed to make up for it. He'd be okay in center. He wouldn't be special or anything, but he'd be okay. I don't think he'd embarrass himself there.
No, I think it'd be really interesting. You know, the problem is that in one game, he might look the part. The problem is over 162 games, he would not look like any part. He would look
Right.
like he belongs in low A
It's like he
or
belonged in the
rookie
Gulf
ball.
Coast League, which is where he's
Yeah.
going.
Right.
And again, he's a really good player. I mean, he's got a chance to be really something special, but it's going to take a while.
I like the question. That was
Yeah, it's
good.
fun. Our next email is from Fred. I don't know where Fred's from. And Fred writes, let's make up where Fred's from. Next email is from Fred, and Fred is from
Let's
Boise.
well, you can tell by the question.
Oh, that's a good question. Okay, so that's your assignment here. Fred writes, "How goes? Just started with the show this season."
Oklahoma.
Okay, Oklahoma. Fred's from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Fred writes, "How goes? Just started with the show this season." I like it this season, but I think he means this baseball season. It makes me think like we're a television series. "And it's instantly become the standard by which all other podcasts are judged, at least by me. We've been hearing a lot lately about how no team takes a draft pick without having a conversation about the bonus amount so they know something of what they're getting into. Why then have some negotiations gone down to the wire? Is that bonus number they talk about beforehand more of a range? Are they negotiating hard about fairly small differences? Do players and advisors play a little fast and loose with how they respond? I understand with cases like a falling Appel, when he didn't expect to be considering the guy and didn't talk to him before the draft day, with no prior discussion, framing talk, shenanigans will ensue. But it seems in past years there are always far more last-minute deals than there were guys who fell. What are teams and prospects negotiating about? They've already got a sense of what it will take at the time of the draft. Also, given the heightened amount of early signings this year, does the new CBA look like it'll create fewer last-minute signings? Since there's more of a premium on knowing specifics of what a player will sign for in order to set up strategy for the rest of your draft, and thus fewer players will have wiggle room, or I'm imagining these conversations to be a lot more specific than they really are. Other factors making signings easier, like lack of major league deals to shoot for. Thanks for all the podcasts." Fred, you're not imagining things. Players are signing at a record pace, including first-round picks, obviously. There are going to be some weird ones, Appel. There are a few other potential ones. And it's very different from the past, because in the past you could lie, and now you can't, because the money's so fixed. And think about a guy like Blake Swihart, who's a catcher in the Red Sox system and a really good one. I really like Blake. I think he's going to be a really
I
good
do too.
prospect. But going into this whole thing, or going into the whole 2011 draft, where there were no spending caps and you could do whatever you want, teams were calling Blake Swihart, and they were going, "How much is he going to be?" And his agent said, $5 million. And they went, uh-oh.
We won't take him.
And exactly. And so the Red Sox, looking around at their first round pick, they really like Swihart. They said, "How much?" And then the agent said, $5 million. And the Red Sox, certainly internally, I'm sure they didn't say it to the agent, went, "Bullshit." And they drafted him. And that dynamic is gone. And so I had obviously ultimately signed for $2.5 million, which is a great deal at 26, for him, for the player. And that he signed in literally the final minutes up to the draft. I'm sure his agent kept saying $5 million. Then with an hour left, he said $4 million. And they said no, and eventually it just went down to some total point where they said $2.5 million. Derek Norris, Derek Norris. God, what is wrong with you?
Daniel Norris.
Thank you. Daniel Norris with the Blue Jays told everybody $4 million the whole time. And that's why he fell completely out of the first round, because we were like, I'm not going to give that guy $4 million. He wants $4 million. I don't have that. We're not going to do that. And the Blue Jays, eventually got to the point where they're like, I mean, look, this is, this guy's still on the board here at 74. We're going to take him and call his bluff. And they did so, and he signed for $2 million. It's a great sign for them. So, but that dynamic's gone, and the specificity so much more this year, where teams in the first round, and even further down, were calling players, and they would have them lined up, and they'd go, and I'm just random team, random pick. They would call player A and go, we'd like to take you here. Will you sign for 375? No, I want 4. Okay, thank you very much. Player B, yeah, hey, would you sign for 375? Yep, you're being taken. And it's been much
do you like
more specific.
That? I mean, do you like that, or do you miss the dynamic where there was a bunch of games being played?
As a reporter, I miss the games, obviously.
Yeah.
But we have a Pell this year. Yeah, that's still going to be a game. I thought we'd have some fun with Joey Gallo. He signed pretty quickly.
Yeah, he did.
And
he
that was
for a lot.
He signed for 2.25, and which is a which is surprisingly quick, because it was pretty clear that Joey Gallo was telling everybody it was going to be 2.5, and he signed for just a little under that, obviously. There's a few guys out there that have numbers that, we don't really know. Appel's a story. Giolito's a story. I think there's a really good chance Washington forfeits their pick next year.
Oh, they're going to go for it.
In order to sign him, knowing that their pick next year is going to be in the 20s somewhere. And, we'll see. So there's still some shenanigans, just not nearly as much.
Yeah.
Next email comes from John. John is in Greensboro, which is in North Carolina. John's not happy with us, Jason.
Okay.
And John writes, I have a comment about the discussion about Javier Baez from the last podcast. The issue of him swinging on a 3-0 pitch. It's kind of out of joint to me that writers of your ilk, and by that I mean guys who take a serious, measured, analytical approach to baseball, and try to frame everything in terms of rational analysis, jump on board so readily with the unwritten rules argument about throwing at opposing batters. I get the tradition, and it's exactly what I've expected to happen in this situation too, but if you take a step back from baseball's tradition, it's irrational and silly. More than that, it's dangerous and irresponsible to have a guy who can throw in the mid-90s, who when he was a minor leaguer probably has not perfected his control to aim a baseball at someone else. Beyond that, this is minor leagues. There's maybe a stronger argument that a guy in MLB should not swing 3-0 with a big lead, but these are prospects who are judged by their performance as to whether or not they have a future in the sport at all. A tiny number of them make it to the show. They need to hit to get there. An established MLB guy can take a pitch. A guy who wants to be promoted needs to mash every time he can. I think the same argument applies to a guy who is fringy in MLB. If you make get a meatball, take a hack, it could keep you on the team. I don't know anything about Baez except what I've learned from you guys, and my perspective is certainly less informed than yours, but this seems like a pretty illogical part of the game and one that risks both players' health and disadvantages their performance. At the big league level, I can see an argument that you have to subsume your personal individual goals for the sake of the team, and I can see an argument that Albert Pujols should never swing a 3-0 pitch, but apart from that, it's a pretty thin argument. And it's based on the sort of intangibles principle that folks in the progressive or analytical baseball community are always decrying in other areas. You don't swing 3-0 because you just don't swing 3-0. It's an unwritten rule, part of the fabric of the game. And the equities don't swing the other way. Is the team going to start throwing BP fastballs when they're down by 10 runs? No. They keep competing even though they're losing, hopefully. And if they have to throw out some rubber arm bullpen depth to get through it, they still try to get people out. So why can't he hit regardless of the count? I liked your discussion of the Baez incident, truly. I'm not trying to nitpick. I'm not even sure I have my mind made up about this issue, or that it's never okay to throw at someone. But I think this part of the game deserves more sound analysis and fewer assumptions. I have the sense that we all assume that the truisms of tough guy baseball hold regardless of whether or not they make sense, and that seems wrong. You both indicated on the podcast that you agreed with throwing at Baez, and your attitude in that segment was less analytical and more, that's just how baseball is, kid. That seemed out of character for both of you. You don't mind my characterizing it that way. It's just that you are both exceptionally rational, clear thinkers when it comes to the game. I believe this is why so many people read and listen to you. And here it seems like a bit of knuckle dragging crept into the discussion. Anyway, that's what prompted my email. Thanks for the great podcast and reading emails, which is a really cool way to interact with your listeners, John. Wow, John, that's a lot.
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't think that everything that we do is measured or rational, because, we look at the intangible things a lot, you know, not, we don't, you know, it's not just a laboratory for us. You know, they're a part of baseball. For me, a lot of the enjoyment I get out of baseball is the fact that it's not just a laboratory, that it's a schoolyard. You know, in schoolyard, there's a lot of, you know, backwards rules that, you know, they may not seem rational, and you can't always, you know, analyze them with any, you know, clarity. But I mean, it's a part of the game that I actually enjoy because it's very childlike and it's very immature, and not everything is so clinical. And that's one of the reasons I really like it.
Yeah, and I'm not gonna be honest with you. I mean, it's you know, a lot of the rational, analytical people don't necessarily like a lot of my ideas. I'm the guy who believes in closer mentality. You know, I believe in that stuff.
Makeup and intangibles and these type of things.
I believe in pitchability. And things like that. And so, you know, maybe we're not as good as you think we are, John. But to talk about this, you know, a player's performance, the way at least you describe it, John, is not the only thing that's going to get him to the big leagues. You know, the kid does have to learn how team baseball works. And the kid does have to learn how to play the game the right way, or it's going to infringe on his development. And so it's not all about numbers. And certainly not at low A is it about numbers. I mean, right now, Javier Baez, who, by the way, went over the right field scoreboard in Beloit tonight, is going up there hacking. I mean, he is just hacking away. And I was talking to a scout about that. He's like, he just goes up there swinging at everything, looking to hit everything, no approach. And I was like, yeah. And the scout went, no, I'm fine with that right now. You know, you're not going to be fine with it when he's at double A. He's like, right now, because he's just getting going, I'm totally fine with it. I'm like, yeah, I'm totally fine with it, too. That's great.
Sure, he's in C-ball, hit-ball mentality.
Exactly,
right now.
And that's fine. He's getting his feet wet. He's figuring things out. He's a really special hitter, potentially. But I have no – again, you know, the thing is, I've actually thought about the unwritten rules, and I'm cool with them.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes –
right, and they might not fit some sort of perfect logic, and I'm cool with that, too.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes they don't make a lot of sense, and – I scratch my head and I'm like, man, does it really have to be a part of the game? But then I think back to what I was saying about how it's not all clinical. It's not all, you know, not everything needs to be analyzed like that. I mean, at its core, it's kind of a childish playground type of game. And sometimes those attributes, you know, they remain. The mythology of the game is built on a lot of immaturity, and it will surface. And sometimes it gets in the way, but I mean, I still like that aspect of it because it's fun, and I kind of like the unwritten rules.
Absolutely. Our next email is from Isaac. Isaac's in New York. He has no town, so we're going to guess he's in Albany. And that's New York.
No, he said he's in New York. He's in the city.
No, the upstate people love to say they're in New York when they're not really New Yorkers. He's in Binghamton or Syracuse or something. Rochester. And Isaac says, it's been a while since I wrote in. I emailed you a while back about a pitcher's velocity at my boarding school. See, he's at a boarding school.
Yeah, you're right.
Tell us what you did, Isaac. What'd you do wrong? How'd you piss off your rich parents and end up in boarding school? And Isaac...
Yeah, it's good for him. He's got a good education.
The recent Andre Ethier extension got me thinking. I assume that front offices listen to pro scouts when assessing how much a free agent is worth. But when a team gives a guy an extension, are they scouting their own players? For instance, with the Ethier extension, did the Dodgers have scouts telling them that Ethier has made some sort of improvement they think he can remain productive 5 years from now? Some teams are probably better at this than others, which could help explaining why some teams always know when to let a player walk, even if they could afford to reassign him. Thanks for the hours of entertainment, Isaac in New York. Good question, Isaac. Teams definitely scout themselves. You know, Jason and I talk to scouts all the time. You always hear, you know, hey, what are you going to go see? Well, I'm going to go see this team and that team, and then I got to go check out our low A team. And you know, they're not just checking them out; they're submitting reports.
No, they're writing reports on their own players. That's the best part.
Right. So you know who you know which prospects you might want to trade and which ones you don't. And which ones helps you assess assignments, helps you assess all sorts of stuff. And they're sitting on their own big league teams as well, obviously.
Right, and it's not just the scouts when it comes to if you're going to sign a player long-term to a deal like that. I mean, you're getting everybody who has
everyone's
a say. You know, the numbers guys, the scout guys, the special assistants. I mean, everybody's going to have some sort of voice for a big signing like that. So it's not a team's not just going to their scouts and saying, what can this guy do? I mean, they're getting those reports to know what that guy can do long term, but they're also dealing with the people who, you know, do the statistical analysis as well.
Sure, absolutely.
Forecasting and projecting.
And I know there was a lot of criticism of the Ethier signing, and I have some of it myself. I just think you're paying a lot of money for the back end of his prime and a good amount of his decline. But, you know, the one thing you always got to remember about these signings is that they don't take place in a vacuum, where you do have to sit back and go, well, if we don't pay Ethier this, which is even too much, who do we put that position? Who are we going to get? Who plays there? What's coming up? What? And maybe that changes the value proposition pretty dramatically.
Right, and they have a lot of money right now. They're trying to lock up a lot of their players. They want to
make some statements.
Yeah, they want to go forward with their a statement. They want to go forward with the talent that they already have, entice other talent to maybe give them a look. I mean, there's a lot of politics that goes in there that's involved with a contract like that too. That's not just player value.
Right. Our next email comes from Jason. Jason's in Chicago. That's in Illinois. It's a lovely city by the lake.
Very good city.
And Jason writes, I was recently at a Midwest League game, and I was sitting behind the plate near a couple of younger guys that looked like they might be wannabe scouts. I noticed that the Stalker radar gun they had on a tripod in front of them had a label on it with the away team's name, and it looked like it had been around a while. I asked if they worked for the team, and one of the guys said yes, they were players. I asked if they were charting, and they said yes. Now, I didn't want to bother them anymore, but I'm pretty sure they weren't lying to me. They weren't, Jason. And I'm certain they were in some way affiliated with the organization. They were, Jason.
They're the pitchers that were due up later that week.
It left me wondering, what exactly does charting entail? And how often are players asked to do it? What are they keeping track of? And are there perhaps more highly regarded players that wouldn't be asked to do this sort of thing?
No.
Thanks for the great podcast. I'll miss it when it's gone, Jason in Chicago. We'll miss it when it's gone, too. And, let's start about, last question first. Are there perhaps more highly regarded players that wouldn't be asked to do that sort of thing? There, I'm not going to name the player, but there was a player who asked if he had to chart, too.
He charted.
The minor league manager said this great statement, that if you start, you chart.
Yep.
And so the starting pitchers do chart the other starting pitchers. They usually do it in teams of two because they're not really paying that much attention to the game, I think. And they're charting every pitch, what the pitch was, the velocity, the result. Sometimes two guys are charting and one guy's charting the pitcher and the other guys are doing like spray charts on the hitters. But charting is a skill and not all of them do it well, Jason.
No, I mean, some do it really well and some don't do it well at all. But they have to do it because, especially at the lower levels, a coach will come over and look at that chart during the game to see what's going on.
Oh yeah.
You know, It's always fun. I usually sit very close to the players when they're charting.
You always help them?
Well, I mean, sometimes I help them if they need the help, but a lot of the time we just end up talking about, like, you know, they know their own players. They know their own team, and it's like, well, that looked like a slider. Well, he kind of throws this hybrid kind of slurve. He's been working on throwing a slider. Well, there you go. I just learned that.
Right.
You know, you can learn a lot from them. I mean, you're not going to – some are better than others, like – as I've said here on the show before, like Cody Buquel with the Rangers, that kid can diagnose pitches like nobody's business. I mean, mm-hmm. He is exceptional when it comes to recognizing pitches. He's one of the best I've ever seen at that age. And then there's some guys who don't pay attention at all. They point the radar gun at the catcher's ass. They get bad. They don't get good readings. They don't pay attention. They can't
dive. Girls in the stands. Get food.
Get food, and they're also on foul ball duty a lot of the time too in the smaller places, you know, at the complex league. So it's fun. It's a lot of fun, and most of them pay attention, but the ones that don't, sometimes they'll ask you what that was.
Yeah, the last game I went to, the two kids charting pitchers kept turning back to me and the scout I was with, and they were just this kind of confused look, and one of us would just go, slider. Okay. That change up. Oh, okay.
That was a fastball. It was 90.
Right. Fine. Yeah. That had no movement. It was 93. What else did that be, kid?
Well, I mean, come on. These guys, every single day is baseball. And when they have to sit in the stands.
Oh, sure. And sometimes something weird comes out of the guy's hand. It's like, you know, 86 and you had a little whiz in it. And you're like, I don't know, cut something. I don't know what the hell that is. And I'm like, does he throw a cutter? I don't think he throws a cutter. I don't know what that is then, kid. I just don't know.
I think they do the best they can.
They do, and you know it's goes into the big data boxes for the teams and the magic computers.
Right, and the older the higher the level, the older the player, the better you're gonna better job they're gonna
Yeah,
make. The lower levels, it's a shit show.
19-year-old starting pitches in the low A ball is not the it's not the best data capturing
Yeah.
system.
19-year-old Dominican kids, that's always
Yeah, you
fun.
gotta learn that. They look back at you and you go, "Cambio."
Cambio. Point the gun up. Liar.
Our final email is an inspiring one. It's from Hudson Belinsky. And Hudson writes, "Gentlemen, rumors have swirled that the podcast will soon be a thing of the past, and I just wanted to drop you folks a line about what it's done for me.
The
When I
podcast
first..."
is going to be a thing of the past.
Huh. What do you know about that, Jason?
I don't know.
"When I first listened to the podcast, I was pleasantly surprised to hear people talking about prospects. There are dozens of people on the internet who will say that Player X has no future because he didn't walk enough in the Gulf Coast League last season. And I was extremely happy to hear two people talking about prospects from a scouting perspective. In episode 60, you guys addressed my question on how to become a scout. There were a few lines that you guys had that really stuck with me, one of which was being, 'You like rental cars? You like driving 30 hours a week? You like never seeing your family? You like taking a shit at McDonald's?' A few weeks later, I'd gone through many of those things, once making it a point to use the most disgusting bathroom in the country. I want to thank you, gentlemen, for that. You opened my eyes to the tough life that many scouts live. The reason I bring this up is because I've traded a lot to put myself in line to see as much baseball as I can this summer. I have a job working on academic baseball research for 50 to 60 hours a week in Albany, New York. I have my own place to live. On top of that, I'm an intern with Baseball Prospectus. I do some video and radar gun work for a scouting website that's run by an associate scout. As of June 10th, I have a baseball-related event on my calendar for every single day through August 5th, when I will be presenting a research project on pitchers' pitch FX data versus weather conditions at the Sabre Seminar in Boston." And by the, if I can break this, look that up, Sabre Seminar in Boston. I'll be your MC for the days. "Scouting will take me to the Cape Cod League, the Team USA Prospect Classic in Durham, and the East Coast Pro Showcase in Syracuse, New York. This summer, I'll make just enough money to pay for my room, car insurance, gas, ramen noodles, and perhaps a new pair of flip-flops. There will be many long drives, which hopefully won't include stops at McDonald's, and I'm really not sure if I'll see my family until the middle of August. The show has helped me find what I am passionate about doing, whether it's blogging about 17-year-olds on a baseball diamond or arguing about Joey shortstops upside in the draft room. I'm confident that this passion will never escape me. I am switching colleges, one of the main reasons being I can now study exercise science, computer science, and physics, three things that will help me improve my player evaluation skills. My scouting endeavors may fail, and I may never work in scouting or player development, but I'm never going to give up. This show has helped me think about baseball in different ways and helped me find direction, and I have hundreds of alcohol reviews to guide me when I turn 21. I wish you all the best, Hudson, who is writes for Halos Daily, is an intern at Baseball Prospectus, is an associate scout at Diamondscape Scouting, and is at Cornell University."
He's got a lot on his plate, man. Good for him.
Hudson, you go.
That's a tale of want right there.
Go and go and go. And on that tale of want, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about baseball with Kendall Rogers in the College World Series. We'll have some goofy stuff, so stick around. Welcome back to the show. It's time to talk about baseball, Jason.
Good.
We're talk about things we wrote. We'll start with something I wrote, which was out today being Thursday, where I did one of those poll of the industry pieces that everyone seems to like so much. And,
Because they're good.
I
People
like
like.
doing them. They're fun to do. It's fun to talk to people on the phone all day. And here's the question, as I posed it. There were two questions. And the first question was, your team is going to play in a championship game tomorrow. I am the baseball genie, and I can grant you any starting pitcher you like. Who do you want?"
Great
And
question.
that was the question. And I got answers from 13 people, and they chose five different pitchers. CC Sabathia and Jared Weaver each got one vote. Clayton Kershaw and Steven Strasburg each got two votes. And Justin Verlander got seven votes.
Not really a shock there with the number one guy.
I gotta tell you, I was kind of shocked that Verlander didn't run away with it more.
And that might be the only shock. All right, I'm actually shocked that Sabathia only got one vote. He's a big game pitcher, you know. That's a guy that I wouldn't mind having the ball, the game on the line.
You got it. Yeah, I mean the guy who voted for him talked about just how much you trust him.
Absolutely.
To pitch well and take it deep into the game, and that was what he was. That's all he could think about was, you know, he was trying to like pitch well and take me deep into the game was more important than kind of a chance to dominate for him, for his thought process.
Sure. Oh yeah.
You know, Verlander, you know, kind of the runaway guy. I think if he did this a year ago, Verlander might have gotten 11 or 12 of the 13 votes. Maybe even would have swept it. But who would your vote be?
It would be Verlander.
I think I would take Verlander as well. And like I said, I was surprised he didn't do well. I was surprised that we only got five names. Some people asked me, you were surprised Cliff Lee didn't get a vote. Yeah, kind of, I could see Cliff Lee getting a vote. I would have understood that one.
Again, it's about timing of when you ask people.
Yeah, I mean, sure. You know, and someone specifically mentioned, you know, the person who took Jared Weaver said, you know, Verlander's in a bit of a funk right now. I don't know how much I'd want him.
Matt Cain didn't get a vote.
Matt Cain didn't get a vote, right. Yes, tomorrow maybe Matt Cain gets a vote.
Right, exactly.
But the follow-up question was just as fun, which was...
I thought it was better, actually.
You know, again, I am the baseball genie. And your team is guaranteed to be playing in Game 7 of the 2015 World Series. You can choose any starting pitching once again, but you have to choose that player right now. Who do you got?
I mean, that's a really tough one. I mean, I kind of would go with who you have number one, which is Strasburg.
I would have went with who we had number two, which is Clayton Kershaw.
And I can see that too.
Of the 13 votes, Strasburg got six, Clayton Kershaw got three, and then four players got one each in Verlander once again, Matt Moore, Gio Gonzalez, and Dylan Bundy, which was awesome. And it was funny because, you know, almost everyone who didn't vote for Strasburg talked about just concerns of, I got to choose this guy right now, and I'm worried he's going to be hurt. A lot of people had no worry about that. Well, you know, one person said, you know, 4 years from now, he's coming into his own. He's got two Cy Youngs in his mantle. I'm taking him all the way. Someone else said, can you just give me Bryce Harper and Mike Trout? I don't care what pitcher you have.
Right. And this guy's kind of boom or bust right now. But if you were to project to 2015, I think that Darvish would be a guy who would receive votes.
Because yeah.
If his command refines, he has the type of stuff that to develop into the type of pitcher who could take the ball in a game one or a game seven. So, I mean, I would see him getting votes. I understand why he didn't get votes at the present, though.
Yeah, I was surprised that no one even mentioned him when they were talking through it and going through their...
Well, he's struggling with his command. I mean, you don't pick a guy for the final game when he could combust.
Right, right. Gio Gonzalez was a pretty interesting choice, but one that makes sense. You know, guy's 26 years old, pitching elite right now, and every year he gets better. You know, Matt Moore makes sense. Verlander makes sense. He'll be 32. Kershaw will be 27. He's, you know, he's only, people forget how young Clayton Kershaw is.
You know, what's really funny is that, you know, because of struggles this year, two guys that would normally appear on lists like this, Felix Hernandez and Tim Lincecum, aren't anywhere to be found.
Never heard their names once, even brought.
Well, I mean, that's interesting, though. Yeah, that's kind of a changing of the guard.
How quickly things can change. That's the thing. We could do this poll next year and get totally different answers. Totally different
right.
answers.
You might be able to do it next month and get different answers.
Right. I mean, what if Matt Cain keeps pitching like this? What if R.A. Dickey keeps pitching like this, even though that's just so damn weird?
I don't think that you can go with a knuckleball guy.
I don't either. I don't either.
What if you did?
That's it's so damn weird ones. What he's doing. It's unprecedented, and I have no idea how to have faith in it because no one's ever done it before.
Right, and think about other guys in the minors, that like Garrett Cole. I mean, if he puts it together...
Right, what if that all clicks?
I mean, he's a guy by 2015. He could be one of the best pitchers in baseball. Right. Not the best pitcher.
Garrett Cole just got the press release. Pitched really well tonight. Five shutout innings, seven Ks.
Right, or Trevor Bauer, as somebody mentioned that they thought about him.
Taijuan Walker.
Yeah, another guy that, you know, he'd be super young, but man, if it's there. I mean, it's in him.
So, yeah, there's all sorts of possibilities here. It could be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
But you wrote something even more interesting.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I wrote about it. It actually kind of started.
I'm pretty sure.
Well, we were kind of talking about this off air, you know, a couple of weeks ago about, and we talk about tools guys a lot.
Yes.
You know, we talk about boom or bust guys a lot. And, you know, a lot of the time when we're talking about these tools guys and the miners who don't get it yet, and it's, or they get drafted or they're in the low minors and it's just not coming together, they're very raw, but their ceiling is still a superstar. What's the prototype for the player who comes into baseball, maybe a multi-sport athlete type, who comes into baseball at a very raw level, who struggles statistically and with all parts of his game in the lower minors for several seasons before the light bulb turns on and that player becomes his ceiling, becomes a superstar? Who's that prototype? Who can we look to as an example of success? Well, that stayed with me a little bit, and I let it marinate, and then I finally reached out, and I sent a bunch of email, text, calls to the industry and to people that I know and to you as well, and we started to talk about it, and you know, nobody had a good one, because you know the obvious examples, the Matt Kemps, the guys who were, he wasn't really raw, he was always pretty good, you know, he showed up with a lot of baseball skill, you know, and a lot of the tools guys who have become superstars, they had a lot of you know, they were raw, but they had a lot of refined skills at the earliest levels, whether it be, you know, approach or feel, instinct. And this kept coming back into the piece a lot, that players without feel, they really struggle to reach their ceiling if they ever do. And it's something that can't really be taught like that. So it's very interesting because we've both said that we love the fact that baseball needs to bring in the athletes. We love it when a team brings in athletes. We talk about the Phillies, the Rangers, Jays, other teams that just, they go for the high ceiling athlete that may not be the baseball player yet to see if they develop. Well, there's not a track record of those players developing into superstars. At this point, it's still very abstract.
Right. Those guys, you think about guys. I mean, the closest we got was Preston Wilson.
Preston Wilson was as close as we could get,
Right.
and
He was the ninth overall pick in 1992. 2 years later, hit 228 with 135 strikeouts in the Sally League, and eventually became a pretty damn good big leaguer, actually. You know, had a couple good years.
yeah, he did. And I mean, a lot of this, I started thinking about a guy like Jordan Akins, a guy that I hype a lot. I love. We've both talked about, you know, the scouts that we've spoken with that rave about his tools. I mean, he is a shed. You know, he is a man. He could be a Matt Kemp type of player.
And
Problem is,
no player in baseball has a larger gap or a larger spread between ceiling and current ability.
exactly. And here's a guy that I keep telling people, oh, be patient. You know, if the light goes on, he could be an absolute superstar, a game changer, a guy with 70 tools, you know, all over the place. I mean, just a monster. The problem is that he doesn't show a lot of instinct for the game, doesn't show a lot of feel. He's in his third season, and he's really struggling in full season ball. And there's not really a precedent for a player that performed the way he has with his sort of tools that managed to become the superstar. And
Right.
that's the whole point of the piece.
Right. There's no one.
No, there's no one. And I mean, obviously the lack of instincts and feel is the main culprit here. You know, he's got good makeup. He's a tremendous athlete. He's an elite athlete. The problem is that he doesn't have a whole lot of feel for hitting. His approach is pretty unrefined, and it remains to be seen if he can put it together.
Pretty unrefined.
Well, I mean, it's very unrefined. I'm trying to be pleasant.
It's dreadful.
But I started thinking about that when the Rangers drafted Lewis Brinson, a guy who, when he was drafted, it was said, absolute tool shed,
Totally raw.
totally raw. Well, it remains to be seen how he comes into pro ball and what kind of, you know, actual skills and feel he brings to the game. Now, if he lacks these things and it's evident in the first couple of years, he will fall into the Jordan Akins type of player, which, as I indicated in the article, doesn't really have a prototype for success. And that was the whole piece. It was kind of just a, you know, an exploratory piece for me, and the answers I came up with were surprising.
And right now, just so people know, Jordan Akins in 60 games for Low A Hickory is hitting .215 with a .243 on base and a .359 slugging. In 209 at bats, he has 71 strikeouts and 7 walks. That's raw.
It's very raw.
So are you to the point where, I mean, did your, has your mind flipped at all? Have you got to the point where maybe we don't take those guys? Maybe we need to change things up a little bit?
No. I mean,
why not? Because it did, I it made me start, I'm starting to think twice about these kind of guys.
I think it depends on the player. I mean, Jordan Akins was not a guy that received $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that when you can lessen some of the risk by taking guys later on in the draft and not paying them a ton of money, and if they don't, if they're boom or bust, if they bust, it's not that big of a hit. That said, I mean, what if Jordan Akins had a lot more feel than we realize, and he came in and he became Matt Kemp? Well, then it's worth the risk, right?
Sure.
But he didn't have it, and you know, it. I think it's one of the things that's really hard to judge. You know, I would not give Jordan Akins $3 million based on his tools, although his tools suggest that he could be a $3 million type of player, but he just didn't have a lot of feel for the game.
Right.
I do not, you know, I don't think that you can have one approach. I think you need to have a lot of different approaches. And I think that getting the best athletes into the game is still important.
I think maybe it makes me think that, you know, after a year or two, when the guy hasn't done anything and he's still that raw toolsy guy, it might be time to really lower your thoughts on him.
I could see that. I could see that.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
The guys who get it actually get it at some point early, and the ones who don't get it early tend to never get it.
Well, I mean, I had a player development guy tell me just flat out that players fail because of, you know, poor makeup, and they fail because they don't have the instincts for the game. They can have all the tools in the world,
right?
But if they don't have the instincts, it's not going to matter. Now, I can't say for sure that Jordan Akins doesn't have any instincts for the game, but it's not showing up in game action. Now, I've seen him look the part before. He's obviously not looking the part on a consistent basis, which is part of the problem. And he wasn't the biggest risk, you know. He didn't receive a ton of money.
No,
it was worth the gamble.
He didn't cost a ton at all.
But, you know, here's something really interesting, and this is something we don't know yet. What if Bubba Starling is the same type of player?
Very possible.
What if he is just an absolute tools freak who doesn't have a lot of instincts for baseball?
There's no feel for the game.
That's a much bigger risk than a guy like Jordan Akins. Or even a Lewis Brinson, who, you know, was only a million-plus type of guy, not a Bubba Starling type of guy that was taken in the...
Not $6 million?
Yeah, not a $6 million. No, that's a different type of bonus. If I'm going to give a tools guy $6 million, I want to see a ton of actual instincts before I sign him.
Right. But
then again, you know, it's all a big risk, you know, and you go for the ceiling, and I'm not against that approach, but, I mean, it is kind of interesting that those types aren't developing, right?
Right.
Right. That's what I discovered.
I thought it was fascinating.
Thank you. And I like doing it.
Did you? That was my next question. Did you like doing it? Because it was a fairly straightforward piece for you.
Well, I did write in Peter Cetera, and I did make a Dwight Yoakam comment.
You did.
In the article.
It was a much straighter piece than a lot of things you do. Did you like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was kind of to see if I could do it one. But then I enjoyed the journey it took me on. You know, it was a process. It was a research piece that I ended up putting down on paper, and I learned a lot from it. And I hope other people were able to, if not learn, but at least have some discussion about it and it'd bring the topic, you know. It's a debatable subject. So, you know, I thought that's what it did. The people at Baseball Perspective sure like to comment on it. I had a good time with the article, and yeah, I'd like to do more pieces kind of like that.
Good. Do you have things in mind? You have to share.
I do not. No, I don't. I don't have anything in mind. That's what kind of happened with this. It was kind of an organic thing. It's like, you know, we were discussing it, and I was like, oh, you know what? You know, that tickles my fancy. Let me work on this. And the next time that comes about, then I'll do the same. Or, you know, if people ask me, hey, this subject, what about this subject? Would you ever think about writing about that? Then I would do something like that.
Right. So let's talk about the Cubs for a second here, Jason.
Always. I don't mind the Cubs.
Cubs have a pretty bad baseball team.
Sure.
Everyone should have expected that. This is not a surprise. This is not a disappointment. This is simply part of the process. But Cubs fans, who at times can be a irrational lot, are just mad because the team stinks. And they should have just accepted the fact that the team was going to stink, and you know, after their loss to Detroit, they are now exactly at 1/3, 21-42, and on pace therefore to lose 108 games, and their anger is now spread to Starlin Castro, And there's also, they got to trade Starlin Castro. Starlin Castro stinks. When in fact, Starlin Castro is the only thing good on that team.
Starlin Castro, the kid who's 22, who's hitting 300 for the third straight year in pro ball.
Right. That guy stinks. And you know why, Jason?
He doesn't get on base.
Doesn't walk.
Well, he doesn't get on base a whole lot.
He doesn't.
That's true.
He's also 22.
Is it kind of are people suggesting this because it's a sell high because the Cubs are bad? They're not going to
do anything. No, I wish it was that rational.
They just don't like him.
They see errors in the field and he doesn't walk and they're getting really into baseball and they're starting to read the analysis stuff and they understand walks are important and he must stuck. And it's just
Starlin, he's a contact guy.
Starlin Castro is younger than Anthony Rizzo, who you're all excited about and hasn't done a thing in the big leagues yet. Starlin Castro is younger than Brett Jackson, who you're all excited about. He's younger than Matt Caesar, who's in high A, and you're all excited about.
Those players play shortstop.
Right.
At the major league level right now.
Right. He plays shortstop. He has 300. There are flaws in his game. One of them is his approach. It's going to get better. His power is going to get better. His approach is going to get better. His hit tool is going to get better. This guy is the guy you revolve the future around. You don't trade him now. And the anger is just unbelievable. That, if you want to hate on, hate on Ian Stewart. Hate on the horrible relief corps. Don't hate on Darwin Barney because he's kind of good. hate on David DeJesus. Hate on anyone else. Hate on Alfonso Soriano, even though he's been playing well lately. But Starlin, just say to yourself, God, we have something really pretty special here. What are you doing? There's actually been talks if he's going to get traded. Why would you trade a 22-year-old cost-controlled shortstop?
The only reason I could think of is if you could, leverage this type of trade for a crazy haul that you would not get if you happen to think that he's not going to get any better than he is now. That's the only way I would trade him.
I don't know anyone who doesn't think he's going to get better now.
Well, I mean, he's only 22. He loves to swing the bat, and sure, his approach is it's too aggressive. But he makes a lot of contact, and he doesn't have a ton of swing and miss.
No, he's going to turn to a 15 to 20 home run guy, and that's going to lead to more walks as well because pitchers will be afraid of him. He's going to be just so good. He's going to compete for batting titles. It's all great. This guy's so good, and I have no idea why you're mad at him.
What's some of the? I mean, is it?
Oh, they got mad. He has a lot of errors and he makes mistakes in the field. He should be in Double A. Double A looks like a pretty good shortstop.
Right. I mean, he's probably not a shortstop long term.
No,
he's not a great shortstop to begin with.
Right. He has some mental lapses in the field. He swings at too many pitches. He's so good. I wish you knew what you had here. You got a 70 hitter playing shortstop.
Talk about instincts. This guy has a ton of instincts for like putting the barrel on the ball.
Yeah, feel for the bat is just unbelievable for a kid so young.
Yeah, he may lack feel and when it comes to approach, but I mean he likes to swing the bat. There's some guys that just like to swing. He likes to swing, and so far, I mean, he's hitting 300 for the third straight year. I mean, it's
when most kids his age are lucky to be in Double A.
I guess part of the problem, and I can see this, is that when he was 20 years old, he hit 300. He had almost got on base at a 35% clip. From there, you say, okay, well, he's just going to get better. Well, the next year, 307, 341. The on base percentage went down a little bit, but so far this year, he's hitting 300 again. That's established, but he's only reaching base at about at a 31% clip.
Yeah,
which is not very good.
No, it's bad. I think there's a lot of pressure on him in the lineup to produce. I think there's a lot of, there's nothing in that lineup that scares you. So pitchers are just going right after him too.
Right, but I mean,
it should be better, but it's not.
I wouldn't bitch at him about him.
Right, it's just amazing, so stop it. And speaking of stopping it, Jason, let's talk about Twitter.
Let's talk about Twitter.
I just want to talk. I get to some questions a lot, and it's not that I'm ignoring you. I'm uncomfortable with them. And one does kind of annoy me. That's made-up trades. It is trade season. Now that the draft's over, it's trade season, so people start saying, could the Blue Jays get Matt Garza or could the Cubs get Travis d'Arnaud and Anthony Goes and Hechavarria for no. And you just don't make up trades. Trades are weird. Trades are not, this is not fantasy baseball. There are all sorts of dynamics from money to personalities to systems to everything that are involved with trades. Don't make up trades. It's the worst part of just complete mental masturbation when it comes to baseball.
Have you seen some like ridiculous ones that you remember?
Always. I didn't make that one up. It was like, you know, could the Cubs get Darnell, Goes, and Hechavarria for Garza? Yeah, and then someone else was like, I hate to pick on Cubs fans here. You know, could we get even more prospects if we threw in Josh Vitters? I'm like, well, if you don't think Josh Vitters is your third baseman in the future, what makes you think another club's going to think that?
Yeah, I mean, some of that stuff is kind of funny. It's like, do you think that we could get this player's best player with some of our mid-level players?
Right.
If we gave them a lot of our mid-level players?
Teams aren't stupid, you know, just because you thought of something. Believe me, they're smarter than you. They're smarter than Jason. They're smarter than me. It's not, no, you just don't make up trades. Just wait for them to happen. Then we'll analyze it and talk about what happened. But yeah, more importantly, I want to talk about ceilings, Jason.
Okay,
because,
I like ceiling.
Because this is the question you get a lot. Hey, this guy, what's his ceiling? I don't want to answer that question anymore, Jason, because it creates unrealistic expectations.
It's almost like a comp in a way.
It's very dangerous. And, you know, someone goes,
I understand why people would want to know that.
I do too. But, you know, someone goes, hey, you know, what's Jerks and Profar's ceiling? Like,
first division all-star?
MVP candidate every year?
But if you say that, then that means he is.
Right, exactly. That's the problem. It turns into, well, Kevin Goldstein said this guy could be an MVP candidate every year. What's Javier Baez's upside? He's been really great. Javier Baez,
an all-star type.
Like a third baseman, like a 60-hit, 70-power third baseman, fucking monster. That's his upside. That's his ceiling.
He's in low A.
Right. Might not do that. In fact, probably won't become that. You know,
just don't.
If you want to play the ceiling game, I can give every team in baseball a team of all-stars. And it turns into this weird thing where I don't want to answer because it just becomes assumed that that's what I think he's going to be when I don't think he's going to be that.
Yeah, I get it. It's dangerous because it doesn't really give you a lot of maneuverability to clarify your point.
Right. I need more than 140 characters. I need 140,000.
So could this guy be this? Yes, he could. But here's the thing is that the developmental process can take its toll in all likelihood. The players who have first division ceilings when they're in low A rarely become first division talents at the major league level. That's just a fact.
And truckloads of them never even get to the big leagues.
Truckloads of them don't even get past double A.
Yeah. It's a weird question, and I don't know how to replace it. And I don't want to not give people information. I just don't like that question anymore. It bothers me every time I try to answer because I'm like, I'm not saying he's this good. Every time I do this, I want to go, I'm not saying he's this good. And I don't have room for it.
I like the Twitter questions when something strikes me funny and I have to go, wait, is this a fantasy question? Because I don't fucking know. I don't understand I don't understand anything about fantasy baseball. I don't understand what kind of league you're in. You're asking me a comparison between two players who aren't even remotely similar.
Yes, those are the strange ones.
And it's like, I don't know what to tell you. I could write a dissertation about this.
Right. Could you rank Nick Castellanos, Aaron Harang, and Billy Hamilton? What?
Well, Hamilton's fast, but I mean, he's not a same type of player.
Right. What a strange question that is. And they're always difficult. And the emails, can you rank these 20 players? No. And again, I don't want to be a shit. I don't want to like not give people information. I don't want to not answer questions. I need to find a better way to deal with those questions as opposed to ignoring them.
Well, I mean, look, if a person wants to know about a player because they're interested in that prospect, that's fine. There are some people who are very aggressive with the questions because it's for selfish reasons. I mean, they're looking to use that information for their fantasy team or for whatever. And it puts anybody who gets asked those questions in a very weird predicament. You know, how do you accurately answer something on Twitter in the first place unless it's a yes or no question?
True.
You know, I mean, it's very difficult. So you do the best you can, and hopefully it doesn't come bite you in the ass and someone says, hey, by the way, remember when you said that this guy could be this? Well, fuck you. He couldn't. It's like, well, come on, man. I didn't say that.
And again, if you follow us on Twitter, we love you.
Oh, no, I love all my followers.
I love all
my followers
Twitter
have been
people.
Fucking awesome this past week. I've really... My Twitter followers have stepped up this last week. They've been very they've been very encouraging in a lot of different fronts. So, I mean, I'm not bashing them at all. I like the relationship I have with them a great deal.
We want to help you. Just when you need to help us help you. That's all I'm saying. So let's take a break, Jason.
Okay.
We'll come back. We'll talk to Kendall Rogers. He's with Perfect Game. We're going to talk about the College World Series in Omaha, and him and Jason are going to argue about Texas.
We're not going to argue. He's probably not going to talk about it.
And then we'll come back to the goofy Texas sticker. Welcome back to the show. It's special guest time. Our next guest is one of the leading college baseball writers in the world, of which there are six. He is writes for Perfect Game. He does an amazing job covering the college beat for them and also does some draft stuff. He's from Texas, and he thinks Rick Perry's a really cool guy. And joining us from his palatial hotel room in Omaha, Nebraska, on the eve of the 2012 College World Series, it's our good friend Kendall Rogers. Kendall, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good as long as you don't ask any clown questions, bro.
Well, let's start with an interesting question here because, I think a lot of people kind of got into college baseball during the Super Regionals, people who aren't normally into college baseball because you had a couple Cinderella stories, most notably, Stony Brook, who won the Regionals a 4 seed, then went to LSU and never trailed them. The only time they trailed LSU was on the walk-off in Game 1. And then you had a second one with Kent State becoming the first MAC school to get to the College World Series since the 17th century. And are we looking at two flukes, two really great stories, two really fun stories, or are we looking at the potential for kind of a bit of spreading the wealth in college basketball where not every year all eight teams are from the South or the West Coast?
Well, I think they're looking at a situation where I think you have two for real teams. I mean, I think if you look at Kent State, obviously this is a program that last year, got to a regional final against Texas. Texas had to beat them twice to advance. Texas beat them twice. They have some studs this year. You look at Kyle McMillan, I believe, is a third rounder. Andrew Chapin was a first rounder. I mean, that team is very talented. This year's team, certainly the only guy they have that's really a top prospect, you'd say, is probably David Starn, a guy that went seventh round of the Braves. But, they're a very talented club. I think they got a chance to make some noise here. I think when you look at Stony Brook, they're kind of the more intriguing club just because, people talk so much about them being a Cinderella team. That's no fault of anyone. I mean, you look at their name for starters and you kind of think Cinderella. But this is a really talented team. I think anybody that watched the LSU series last week, not only did they play like head-to-head with LSU, but I was just impressed in that atmosphere and that environment. The biggest biggest crowd they had played in all year long was something like 1,000 people. And they went in a place like Baton Rouge, it can be pretty tough to play in, and kept answering LSU. I thought they played much better than LSU all weekend long, and they made all the big plays. So I think when you look at Stony Brook, you obviously look at this team as a very talented club. You look at Travis Jankowski, obviously, first supplemental pick to the San Diego Padres. Obviously, Pat Cantwell, third-round pick to the Rangers. Then you look at my personal favorite, William Carmona, real thick, big catcher, just knocks the hell out of the ball every time he hits the ball. But, he's a guy that's the 11th-round pick to the Phillies. And, of course, you have Max Tissabon, the native Canuck, there in the 11th-round of the Padres. So this is a very talented club. Matt thinks really put together a nice team. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. They have a tough matchup with UCLA in the opening game. But if they can get past UCLA, watch out for these guys. Kent State, a team I think will beat Arkansas. DJ Backfield in the opening game. I don't see them winning that bracket over Florida, South Carolina, but they certainly can make some noise as well.
Well, I mean, how does Stony Brook get this good? Because, I mean, like you said, I mean, yes, it's a great story and Cinderella and not expected and all that stuff, but they do have good players. I mean, is this just a tribute to their recruiting efforts and their ability to kind of identify talent that's not going to the big schools?
No, I think you have to nail on the head. I think it's identifying players. I think when you look at them and St. John's has plenty of guys, and I guarantee you, somebody in the SEC never knew who Jeremy Baltz was at St. John's, for instance. I guarantee no one in the SEC or the ACC knew Travis Jankowski was. So I think it's a testament to the job the Matt Sheik and his coaching staff has done, and I've identified talent. The most interesting thing to me is if you look at Stony Brook and you even throw Kent State into the mix. Kent State's a team with 27 players from the state of Ohio, seven additional players from Western Pennsylvania. You look at Stony Brook, I think 15 of their players are from New York. They've got a couple of Canadians, and most of the other guys are from Pennsylvania, Connecticut. So it's not like they're going out in other parts of the country and finding good players. They're just finding the guys they think that can project well and continue to get better as players. And they're turning them into good players. So, to me, that's a testament to those coaching staffs more than anything else.
Well, I mean, let's look at bracket one, which is the bracket that has Stony Brook. I mean, it's a great story, and yes, they played. I mean, not only did they beat LSU, it didn't look like a fluke. They looked like they belonged all three games. But do they really have a chance here? I mean, at some point, this has to turn to a pumpkin, right?
Well, I think if there's one team that has a chance to. Could be the team that goes 0-2 and just kind of falls here. I think it is Stony Brook. There's so many people around here and around the country that are just falling in love with these guys. I mean, they're getting pampered here in Omaha. Everybody's a fan of them. Yeah, they took care of LSU on the road, but that's a lot of pressure to deal with. But I think when you look at the rest of that bracket, I'll look at South Carolina as Florida. It's kind of either one of those teams is going to advance. That ought to be a great matchup tomorrow night. You look at Brian Johnson. Going on the hill from Florida against Michael Roth of South Carolina. Both those guys, completely different guys. You look at Johnson as a big-time prospect. I thought he looked fantastic in the SEC tournament. And Michael Roth, the type of guy who barely breaks glass. So it'll be interesting to see that matchup. I think that's a rematch of last year's National Championship Series. And I think that's going to be the game that decides essentially who wins this bracket that we're talking about here.
And I mean, on the other side of things, you got UCLA, who's just a really good all-around team, and Florida State,
Yeah.
who just absolutely dismantled Stanford in two games, scoring 35 runs. Four of the top eight seeds are in the College World Series, including the top three, which are Florida, UCLA, and Florida State. Is it kind of foolish to look at anyone other than those three teams as winning it?
No, I don't think there's a problem with that. I think we look at Florida State. I mean, you're talking about a team that made Mark Appel look like a 21st rounder, not a first rounder. I think you look at the job they did over the weekend. They outscored Stanford 35-8 against Mark Appel and Brett Manningham. That's pretty damn impressive, to say the least. So, Florida State's playing a good brand of baseball. You look at Mike Martin, their head coach, has been here 21 times and never won the national championship, so maybe this is the year they do it. Arizona, interesting enough, I think they're a very, very good club. I mean, offensively, it doesn't get much better than those guys. And Alex Mejia, shortstop for them, has really had a great year, really, really solid down the stretch. And I think when you look at UCLA, they're not a team. They don't have a Garrett Cole throwing 96 or 98 or whatever. They don't have a Trevor Bauer. But Adam Plutko's a guy who'll probably be a pretty decent draft pick next year. Big Vanderteeg in the same boat, and the starting rotation's done a nice job. So then you look on the opposite side of things, Derek Gillis has really stepped up for the Bruins this year. So I think out of that bracket, I'm kind of looking at either one of those three teams to come out of it. I just think when you look at the job that Florida State and UCLA have done, Arizona, those teams have been very consistent all year long. Florida State kind of being an interesting team because, historically, you think of Florida State as an offensive club, but this year, they're hitting about 270, but probably the last couple of weeks they're actually probably getting around 350. So they're really heating up.
Now, let's talk about college baseball in general, just because the regionals were easy to watch, except for that one crazy 21-inning game that nobody could watch. All the super regionals were on various ESPN outlets, and you could watch them online if you have the right provider and whatnot. What is the I mean, is college baseball more popular than ever? And maybe more importantly, is it more successful than ever?
I think it's a combination of both. When I started covering college baseball on the national scale about 10 years ago, and I remember not only was it only me and about Baseball America at that point, I think it was Will Kimmy was there. Not only was it only about me and Will covering it nationally, but it wasn't on much. I mean, you may have had a couple of super regionals on television. That was about it. Now you've got every super regional on television. You've got pretty much every regional at least accessible in HD, whether it's online or via ESPN. So there's no doubt the sport's growing. You look at moving from Rosenblatt to essentially a big league ballpark. There's no doubt the sport's growing. I think the biggest thing that you notice with the sport is you're getting better players. I think the biggest draw is, I think, just the College World Series in Omaha. I think kids grow up. I know I did. I mean, I knew I grew up watching Todd Walker, watching the Texas teams, and even the once or twice the A&M teams were in Omaha. I grew up watching all those teams. I remember watching all the guys that are future big leaguers play in the World Series. So I think now kids are seeing those things and going, you know what? You know, yeah, there's certain kids out there who want to sign and get it over with and go play pro ball. But there are also a set of kids out there who say, you know what, that seems pretty damn cool. You know, I want to go play some college baseball for a couple of years and maybe get a chance to go to the College World Series. So it's interesting to kind of go on a different tangent here, but it's kind of interesting because you look at college baseball and you look at all of us, probably including you guys. I mean, I thought the new CBA would really benefit college baseball, and I think it will eventually. But, I mean, I think when you look right now, I mean, you're seeing a lot of kids signing for $100,000 and $150,000 out of high school, and that's really surprising me right now.
Yeah, for sure. And you're seeing all those kind of post-10th round kids once the senior shenanigans ended, you're seeing all these 11th through 16th round kids signing for between $100,000 and $250,000. And you're right. It did look like it would be for college baseball, but as college baseball grows and gets more popular, I mean, obviously there's kind of no window for it to be ever become as popular as, say, college football and college basketball.
No.
But what is the ceiling here? I mean, what is the maximum interest we can generate here? I mean, could we get to a point where, you know, the top players are household or semi-household names before the draft goes off the board?
I think there could be a time. I think when you look at the way the MLB farm systems are organized, I think for college baseball to essentially, I think it's going to continue to get more popular. But for the, I guess to make a quote, you kind of make a phrase about it, for the lid to kind of come off on it and become even bigger, I think you'd have to see some restrictions on farm league teams. For instance, maybe if the major league or the major league organization cut out short season or something like that, you know, they'd have to cut out something or shorten the draft by quite a bit for college baseball to become bigger, because you have to have more players that need to go to college. And right now, there's plenty of guys that don't need to go to college. So, you know, you're seeing more and more top talented guys going to college, but not near enough for what you could see. So, it's hard to say what the ceiling would be. I mean, 10 years ago, if I would have told you that every single game would at least be accessible via ESPN somehow, I would have probably thought you were kidding around. So, you know, who's to say what's going to be the case in 10 years? There's no doubt that even MLB sees the college baseball on the rise. You look at the fact that MLB has talked to college, the NCAA, about helping fund scholarships for schools who can't afford 11.7 scholarships. So when MLB has come out of their way to say, hey, guess what, we want to fund scholarships, something's going right there, because they wouldn't want to throw a bunch of money at something if they didn't think it benefited them in the end. So I think MLB kind of sees a lot more kids at least are saying they want to go to college, and we'll see what happens. They're certainly on the right path.
Now, you said you've been covering college baseball for around a decade, and you know, I'm not going to lie, Kendall, not a huge college baseball guy. During the season, I will watch a lot of games just to, like, I want to see that draft guy kind of thing.
No doubt.
But I'm not paying attention to winners or losers. I do, you know, watch a lot of games once we get into the postseason. But, you know, just, I mean, sell us on it. I mean, what is it about? Obviously, you love college baseball. What is it about the college game that appeals to you so much?
Well, I I've had this discussion with a buddy of mine, Jason Cole, who you guys obviously know plenty about, but You know, the difference is from a scouting perspective, like you said, you watch games to just watch the guy, and I'm fine with that. I do that quite a bit, finding myself do that quite a bit as well. But I think what makes the college game attractive to me and to plenty of other people out there, the simple fact that, you know, how much passion you're laying on the line. You know, if you're on a minor league team in A ball, I mean, how much do you really care about whether or not the team wins? I'm not saying none of those guys
I don't care at all.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if you're at Stanford, let's say you're at the University of Texas and you're playing Texas A&M in Omaha. I mean, that, you know, to a lot of people, that's everything. I mean, if you lose to Texas or you lose to A&M in Omaha, I mean, people are all over the state of Texas are pretty pissed off. So that makes it, in addition to playing the game, that brings passion to the game. It brings kind of an identity. I think it's a lot of it's identity. I mean, kids are up in South Carolina to go play in South Carolina. They're representing the state of South Carolina here in Omaha. Kids at Stony Brook feel like they're representing the state of New York. So I think it's not only school pride. I think you're talking about state pride. And when you combine those two things into competitive sport, you have a pretty intense situation there. So I think that's what makes it special. I mean, you know, just seeing when a team hits a walk off and knocks a team out in Omaha. You know, some people say they hate to see grown men cry, but you know what? It's almost relieving in this day and age to see players and coaches and people like that just kind of invest so much energy into the game of baseball. I think to me that's what makes it so special, and it's been intriguing just to see players and teams on both sides of the equation over the years.
Now, you are from Texas. There's no Texas team in this tournament. Does that depress you?
No, not at all. I mean, this is the first time since 2001 you have not had a single team from Texas here. I think it was a down year for that state in general. I mean, I think you look at
Texas didn't even get a postseason bid, right?
Yeah, they didn't even get a regional bid. It was just a down year. I mean, A&M kind of choked away in their regional. They didn't play very well. The Rice didn't play very well in their regional, and of course Texas fell short of getting to a regional. So it certainly was a down year in Texas, but I have little doubt that most of those teams will get it going again.
So it's time to make your picks here. Let's start with bracket one, which begins tomorrow with Stony Brook versus UCLA and Arizona versus Florida State. Who's the first team out, and who's the team to come out of that bracket?
Oh, man, you're going to give me the tough questions already.
Haven't you written a preview article yet, Kendall, where you made your decision?
Yeah, I have not actually made our prediction. I'm going to go Florida State wins the bracket. I'm going to actually say that Florida State for once pulls their head out of their ass in Omaha and wins the bracket.
And who's the first team out?
I'm going to be really mean here. I'm going to go with the Fighting Seawolves of Stony Brook.
Okay.
I'm going to go with the Mythical Long Island Creature as the first team out of here.
And in bracket two, which begins the following day, Kent State versus Arkansas and South Carolina versus Florida. Who comes out of that bracket, and who's the first team out?
All right. I'm going to go with Florida, although even though there's probably two people from South Carolina listening, they're going to get mad at me, but I'm going to go with Florida as the winner.
Wait a second. You think there's only two people from South Carolina listening to this show?
I don't know how many people from South Carolina can handle listening to Eagles, team. I don't know. You guys talk politics on here sometimes, don't you?
Sometimes.
There's not many South Carolina people that would agree with you on politics.
That's what you think.
Hey,
he's probably right, though.
It's characterizing the great people from the great Palmetto State. There's plenty of people from South Carolina who listen and love to this show. It's a lot more than just a couple, pal.
Oh, I know.
Are we straight on this, Kendall?
Oh, we're good. We're good. I always knew you were kind of a South Carolina type of guy.
So you got Florida winning. Who's the first team out?
I'm gonna go with Arkansas. I'm gonna go with Kent. I'm gonna go with the Fighting Flashes. The Flashes beating Arkansas. I'm gonna go with Arkansas losing to South Carolina in the losers bracket.
So now you have an all Florida College World Series final with Florida.
I do. It's interesting how I got to that point, right?
It is, and so it's a best 2 out of 3. I need a winner for the 2012 College World Series, and I need a final score of each game as well as how many triples each team hits.
Okay, I'm going to go with the Gators, and I will go with 5-4, 10-6, and that'll be the series.
Excellent.
And then the number of triples, I'm going to go with 2.
Now, Kendall, you're from Texas. Jason is from Texas.
We don't claim Jason very
well. No, that's not true. Don't listen to his bullshit.
He's from Dallas. He's from Oklahoma.
There he goes. He likes to play. This is his narrative. This is his game. He likes to play.
And where in Texas are you from, Kendall?
Well, I grew up in East Texas. I live in Austin.
But where did you grow up in Texas?
He grew up in Louisiana, basically.
In where?
Kendall, what town did you grow up in?
A town called Lufkin, Texas, in East Texas.
Lumpkin?
Lufkin.
Lufkin.
Lufkin. What's Lufkin? I've heard of that town from high school kids. What is that near?
Just about an hour north of Houston.
Okay. And so you grew up in Lufkin, which is an hour north of Houston, and you think because Jason grew up near Dallas, he doesn't count or something?
That's what he thinks, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm telling
you. Could you explain the thinking behind that?
He can't explain his thinking. He's from East
you
Texas.
You ever been to Dallas? It looks just like Oklahoma.
No, he's just taking shots at me. Just let him take it. It's okay.
Okay.
But
there's things you two agree on. Do you two agree on what should be and not be in chili?
Yeah, no beans in chili, only sirloin beef.
Right. We're going to agree on most of that shit.
And since Jason can't really explain it very well, can you explain why people from Texas think there's just something special about being from Texas, even though they're just from another state in the union?
I think we had this discussion the last time I was on the podcast.
And we didn't get a good answer.
He likes to ask people. He doesn't. He needs clarification. He doesn't get it.
Well, it all starts in the fact that we used to be our own country. That's pretty much all it stems from. And the fact that we don't need anybody else.
So what's your plan for
I will say this, and Parks can back me up probably here. I would say that, and trust me, Parks or myself are certainly not these secession idiots. But I would say most people from Texas, if they had the choice, would probably prefer Texas to still be a country.
No, that's true. I mean, I don't like the secession bullshit at all, but if Texas became its own country again, I'd probably, I'd be back down there.
as long as Rick Perry was not our president.
Right.
So what's your plan for attack here in Omaha? Obviously, you're going to be at every game, which could be as many as...
You changed subjects on me.
I know.
You didn't like the answer we gave. It was too good.
You're from Texas. I'll talk slowly. Don't worry about it.
I don't think Goldstein appreciates the true essence of being a Texan.
He doesn't know it.
I'm feeling slighted here. Yeah, I really am.
Yeah, I know what it smells like. So
success.
because Illinois like smells wonderful.
Texas smells like want.
we can't all live around a city where thousands of people getting murdered all the time.
What, Dallas or Houston?
I would say Chicago is looking pretty rough right now.
Oh, you're one of those people. Eight cities. So you're in Omaha now. What's your plan of attack in Omaha? I mean, you could be covering as many as 17 games here in 11 days.
Yeah, fun, isn't it?
You tell me.
Oh, it's fun. By about the second week, you realize you're in Omaha and you're ready to get out of here.
So, I mean, are you going to be writing game stories every day over at Perfect Game?
Yeah, everything you can imagine. I'll try to bring a little scouting perspective to it, but just game story analysis. Trying to do a few off the field things and try to add a little scouting stuff. Try to do the whole bit a little bit.
Have you eaten at the Drover yet?
I just did tonight, actually. I met John Manuel and Aaron Fitz over there. had a little Drover action.
That's quite a meal.
Wonderful as always.
So if people want to read your stuff during the College World Series, they go to Perfect Game. And if people want to follow you on the Twitter, they go where?
Kendall Rogers PG.
Okay. And Kendall, thanks for coming on. Have fun in Omaha and keep being a Texan.
No problem, man. Why'd you send you some cowboy boots? It looked good, that fedora.
Goodbye, Kendall.
Take care, man.
Welcome back to the show. It's time for the goofy stuff, Jason.
Get goofy.
We begin with our musical guest, and it's Dimesland. And they are, thrash metal band. I saw them live a few weeks ago, of course. We talked about this on the show. I went to Oakland, California on the final night in Oakland, California. I went and saw Kowloon Walled City play, which, of course, has the great Ian the Vegan on bass. And this band opened for them. And I said to them, hey, I have a podcast. We'd be happy to play your music. And the guy sent me an email and said, here's our music. That would be awesome.
Cool.
And Alternative Matter wrote this about their EP, Creep Moon. And you can get more information about this EP at their website, dimesland.com, which is exactly what it sounds like, dimesland.com. And this is from the Alternative Matter review. Imagine, if you will, an EP of tunes that batter you from your speakers with colossal thrashing guitar riffs that scythe through each piece over frantic drum patterns in a variety of awkward and disparate time signatures and blast beats. Add a hammering bass line and a side order of discord, and you get some idea of what to expect from the eventful debut release of Oakland, California's bass Dimesland. Creep Moon flows through the listener's ears with a hint of chaos, but afforded enough time and effort, indicate technical proficiency and efficiency that is hard to dismiss. There's an immense amount of chaos and excitement about these 18 minutes, but the chaos never at any time feels uncontrolled. Dimesland may have released a truly original piece of abstract and tentative work that goads the listener away from mere genre-defining and into unsullied, exhilarating territory.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sold. I like that type of music.
High praise, indeed. Yeah, they're good. It's good. I mean, there's metal can be easy. I mean, metal can be, you know, a drop D tuning, one finger move around, and you're playing metal. These guys are interesting, and the time signatures, like the guy said, they mix things up a little bit. It's an interesting sound. They were very good. I was impressed with them. And so this is Dimesland, and as always, we want you to support our guests and go to dimesland.com. You can figure out how to get their EP and then see upcoming shows and good stuff like that. And thanks to them for getting in touch with us and letting us play their music. Jason, very important question.
Yeah.
What are you drinking?
I am drinking a 6-point Righteous Ale.
It's a repeat offender, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. I like the 6-point stuff. It's got a high alcohol volume, so I don't drink very many of them because I have a lot of work to do, even tonight, even though it's late because we had to wait on Kendall's ass. But it's good. It's a darker beer. You wouldn't like it. It's very beer tasting.
It's beery?
It's very beery, which means I think it's delicious. but yeah, it's at this point, it's cold. It's in a nice glass. I'm enjoying it. What are you drinking?
I just have a glass of juice.
Wow.
It's 100% juice. It's cranberry pomegranate cherry juice from the Ocean Spray Company.
100% juice, huh?
Mm-hmm. No artificial anythings, no syrup, no anything. 100% juice.
Just a bunch of juice.
Just a bunch of juice, that's all.
You should pour that into a beer. You'd probably enjoy it.
I might. If I had one, I would do so, and I would go, hey, that's good. I like that. I think I've come up with something.
Oh, funny times.
That's all I got.
Funny times with fruit drinks.
I'm so lame. Pop culture moment, Jason. You wrote a piece this week. about some of the big storylines and what is we're kind of almost at the halfway point of the minor league season.
Yeah, about to hit the All-Star games. I think
Yep.
we've crossed the game threshold for halfway.
And so now that we're there, you wrote this story and you kind of connected it all with quotes from Boogie Nights.
Yeah, I mean, I love Boogie Nights. It's one of the most quotable movies in a long, long time.
Did you choose Boogie Nights because it's been on cable a lot lately?
No, I don't. I don't really have cable.
Because it has been on cable a lot lately, and it reminds you of how good it is.
No, no, I haven't. I haven't actually seen it lately, but I like to just quote it. And it actually started pretty innocently enough. I was just IMing with a friend, and a Boogie Nights quote came up. And it stuck in my head, and I was like, you know, I didn't end up using that quote, but, you know, I went and looked up a bunch of the quotes, and I was like, man, I could totally make a story out of this. And, you know, I love the movie, and it's a classic. It is one of the better movies of the 90s.
I think it's the best movie of the 90s. I'll go that far.
It's up there. I mean, I think there are a lot of movies in the 90s that I enjoyed a lot. But it's definitely up there. I like all of his movies.
Paul Thomas Anderson.
But Paul Thomas Anderson. But Boogie Nights, there's something about it that, you know, it's very Altman-like in the fact that he's got all these different storylines and all these different characters, and the acting is good and the writing is so good that, you know, I know that the setting is a porn star, but it doesn't really matter.
No, it's a lurid subject, but the whole tale is kind of an allegory of the modern family and where one finds acceptance.
Yeah, I mean, I like the porn story. It's great and all, but I mean, the characters are what make that movie, and you get into the lives of so many different characters, and the writing is so crisp, and it's the dialogue is so real,
the filmmaking itself is pretty remarkable as well.
Oh man, he busts out just tons of fucking technique. It's really well made. It's really well written, and it's actually really well acted. I love the quotes from the movie, and I thought that I could put them into a reference with minor league storylines that would play pretty well. But it would give me an opportunity just to use Boogie Nights quotes, which is basically what I wanted, you know. And I kept it, you know, PG. I didn't use any of the, you know, the real. I could have gone crazy with it, and some of those quotes would have been just fantastic too, because I could have worked with those just as easily. No, but I had a lot of fun. I actually had a lot of fun writing it because I would chuckle at each quote because it would take me back to that point in the movie.
Do you have it on disc?
I do. I do.
Because if you have it on disc, either DVD or Blu-ray, I'm a big fan of director's commentaries, but they are hit or miss. Some are good. That's the best director's commentary of any disc I have.
Yeah, it's good. I really like it. I like his approach to filmmaking. I like how he sets the stage. I like how intellectual he gets about subject matter that's very immature at times. So, you know, he's talking about a certain setup in the porn scene. And, you know, they're talking about in graphic detail about the porn scene. But he goes into, like, this intellectual rant, you know, about, you know, he was watching Network or something, and it inspired him to use this type of shot. And it's like, wow, you know, this is a serious film.
Yeah, no, it's pretty incredible, and he'll talk about a lot of films that influenced the film and shots that influenced him. And you mentioned Altman, and there is a, you know, there's a the opening shots like is one shot, and you get every character in the film in that one shot.
As yeah, it just he kind does of a lot of steady cam stuff.
Tons. So I don't.
Scorsese like take you through.
I don't know if Boogie Nights is on Netflix, just because. I have it on disc and you have it on disc, but if you have not seen Boogie Nights, it is a remarkable piece of work.
It really is. It's a true piece of art.
It's one of the best films.
17-year-old piece of gold.
it's one of the best films you'll ever see.
I love the Colonel, man. The Colonel is great.
The Colonel is great. He likes butter in his ass. And
may I see it? Thanks, Eddie. And a smile. Thanks, Eddie.
Thanks, Eddie. Philip Seymour Hoffman is a brief role in which he just steals the show.
Don Cheadle is amazing in it.
Cheadle's fantastic in it.
John C. Reilly is fantastic in it.
If you like John C. Reilly, it's actually his best role ever.
He was pretty good in Hard Eight.
He was good in Hard Eight, which was Paul Thomas Anderson's first movie.
Yeah. Sydney, if you can
if you
catch
want
his version.
If you want to, yeah, if you want to be a snob about it.
Right.
Oh, you mean Sydney? Okay.
No, I mean I have it. I have it as Hard Eight. It's you can tell that where he, you know, he wanted to take it another direction, but I mean it's still a good movie.
It is a good movie, and Boogie Nights was like the film after he made that, and he talks in the commentary about how hard it was to get anyone to let him make it because it was just going to be a second film. And he was like, and he was just so burned on making his first film. He just said, if I make this film, it's going to be about this, and it's going to be rated R. I get to do whatever I want with the cut. I can do whatever. This is my movie. I can do whatever I want with it. And it took time for someone to say yes to him.
Yeah, I mean, because it was based on a short that he did called The Dirk Diggler Story.
Right. And which was loosely based on
the John Holmes documentary,
which I've seen.
I have seen too, and there's one scene in particular.
There's a couple things because there's like a fake Dirk Diggler documentary in the movie,
right?
And some of that's shot for shot steals.
Sure, like when it's kind of grainy, like that documentary, and it shows Burt Reynolds, who's fantastic in the movie, talking about how it's Amber Waves making the movie about Dirk Diggler, and he's talking about being able to block his own scenes and whatever, and that's an exact ripoff. Or an exact take from the John Holmes documentary when he claims that his director allowed him to block his own sex scenes, which he did not. So yeah, it's fantastic.
And he has a movie coming out this year called The Master, which I've only seen kind of the teaser trailer for, and it looked pretty intriguing. That being Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, I mean, I think I do believe it's a criticism of Scientology pseudo religion.
It has Joaquin Phoenix. I know Philip Seymour Hoffman's back. I don't know who else is in it. But
probably about 10 people that you may not know their name, but you're like, oh, that guy.
Oh, yeah, that guy's in every one of his movies. And it goes from there. So, again, Boogie Nights, highly recommended. Go see it. If you don't, you're a fool.
Yeah, that sums it up.
What do you got going on this week, Jason?
I'm working on a more NL Central prospects. And then... start of New York Penn League next week. So
yeah, season action.
Fuck yeah, I am very excited. I am going to be hitting a lot of games in Staten Island, of course, and Brooklyn. I'm the one good thing about the CBA that I can't bitch about is the fact that a lot of these players have signed.
Right, kids get on the field.
Kids are getting on the field. And so in years past, like last year, I was really lucky with Staten Island. We had a lot of talent there, but Brooklyn, not so much. Well, let's hope that, you know, with the other teams coming to town as well, there's going to be just a lot of young, fresh talent, either coming up from complex league ball or coming straight from the draft, getting their feet wet for the first time. And so it's kind of difficult to scout those guys who just signed, who just come into pro ball, because the results are going to be mixed. And so the scouting is kind of difficult, you know, but you do get to kind of paint a framework of a player, even if it's raw, or even if they're just getting their feet wet, or if they're tired after a long collegiate season.
Right.
But no, you still get to see what the player looks like in person. You get to kind of make a representational image of that player, and it starts to become a little bit more real for you. So the scouting reports start to make a lot more sense. So, man, I'm thrilled to death. I cannot wait to go see more baseball. And then at the end of next week, and I guess we'll be doing a podcast before then, but then we're both going to Texas.
Right.
So what do you have?
Well, Tuesday is the Midwest League All-Star Game, Jason.
Oh yeah.
So, and that's in my semi backyard at King County. Miguel Sano, Jorge Bonifacio.
You love Bonifacio.
I do. Francisco Lindor, Josh Sally.
Oh wait, he made the All-Star team? Shocking.
Steven Moya, Ryan Brett, Jace Peterson, Chris Hawkins. Every single really good arm with the Toronto team, and there's a lot of them.
In all of them.
Right, in all of them. So it's going to that on Tuesday. I'm hoping to find enough time to do the whole thing. I want to get there like at 2:33 and do BP and everything.
BP's great.
Oh yeah, BP's awesome. And so that's the plan right now.
That's
my folks, the Midwest League All-Star Game. Then we'll be in Texas.
But I do want to say before we call this a day that last week on the podcast, I said some pretty personal and emotional things, and I have to say that, you know, that wasn't easy for me to do, but the response has been overwhelming, and I'm touched. And the people have sent email and sent me tweets and IMs. I mean, it's been pretty overwhelming, and with support. And I at a time like this when I'm pretty upset about things, I mean, I really, really appreciate it. So I just wanted to throw that out there to the people who are listening to this, because it's very touching. You didn't have to do it, and I appreciate it. I really do. Thank you.
Well done. Let's end on that.
Okay.
Time for the saddest part of the show, Jason.
That was the saddest part
no.
of the show. Oh, I thought when we had Kendall on was pretty sad.
That was sad as well, yeah. This is simply when you say goodbye.
Goodbye, Internet.
And thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you next week, and we'll have all sorts of stuff to talk about. We'll have All-Star Games and short season ball. So we'll see you. I'll just say next week. Again. We'll see you next week, next week, next week.
Reflect what's been sold.